kids, it's time to get some SML podcast all up in that.
What's up, everyone? This is the SML Podcast. I am your host, Joe. It is Wednesday, which means I am being joined by Pernell Vaughn. How are you doing?
I'm sitting here dreaming of dinner that I somehow managed to skip over today after losing my wallet and driving all over the darn place to find it. Turns out, where was my wallet? In my gym bag. The same gym bag that I checked two times prior.
So, I am so proud of you.
I am not. this is like the worst off day ever until tomorrow. I'm sure I'll trump it.
But oh boy.
I don't know. Maybe it'll be these a fun weirdness where I'm like, oh man, I had a sub and forgot where I put it. And when I finally found it, someone had left a second sub for me to find. So I have two subs now. That would be good.
Bonus subs. That's always good. Why did someone leave a sub with it?
I don't know. Maybe it was, you know, sometimes people like take a $20 bill, like, you know, people with money, mind you, and I'll just like drop it in on the ground intentionally. And like, you know, hey, that guy just found 20 bucks that I left for him. And for him, that's a lucky find, like just to brighten someone's day. You know, he just happened to notice a sub. He knew he could just go grab a sub, put one next to my sub. Yeah, there's two subs. And if the guy happens to find it, that guy being me, it's just a little lucky grab to make my day feel better.
Maybe someone thought it was like a used sub collection area.
What do you know? I didn't like my sub either. I'll just put the rest of it here. He can eat it.
This guy left his. I might as well leave mine here too. Fuck it.
Yeah, it must be some sort of sub transfer repository. I don't know. Make it work. It'll get down. It'll get done. Someone will eat it.
Oh, although, Lord.
It'd be better if it was a cheesesteak repository.
Now you're making me hungry. Stop it, Pernell. What are you doing?
That actually brings a question I had, because it came up when I was in Telford not too long ago. What is it like for you guys to get cheesesteaks? Does the places up there actually know? I mean, because they're still close to Philly, but it's also still remote. And the last time I went to a rope place, like, I want a cheesesteak. The guy was like, we have steak sandwiches. I'm like, no, I want a cheesesteak. You know what cheesesteak is? No, no. We got two rye slices of bread. And we put some meat in between. Like, that's not a steak. Not a steak. So I'm curious, like, is there any place like that near you, or is it pretty straightforward? You can get a good cheesesteak when you want one.
I don't know. I don't really go out searching for cheesesteaks. I'm not a big fan of, like, peppers and onions, which is standard on all cheesesteaks.
Oh, no, like, not for me. They're not. I won't touch that crap on my steak.
When I get them, it's steak and cheese only. That's it.
I get like that sometimes, but I'm all about seasonings. I learned about a place recently near me where, because I'm also put pickles on there now, which is something I never did before this place, but they're all about seasoning the meat. So you can just get a seasoned cheesesteak with your, you know, cheese and one condiment if that's what you want. But they season the meat up so well that that's fun because the flavor is in the freaking meat itself and not in all the toppings people slam on.
Yeah.
It's probably one of the best cheeses I've ever had in my life. Any or not in Philadelphia. It's mind-boggling. Also, fun fact, Corner Steak and Steak, those steaks are way overrated. There, I said it. I don't care anybody. Overrated. Pat's and Gino's. Overrated as hell. But, it is what it is. They don't even season it. I don't think they even cook the meat all the way sometimes because they're so busy trying to run the brushes that they don't have time to finish cooking the food.
Yeah, that's not good. You need fully cooked food.
You really do. Brings out the most of the flavor. No one of those, like, give me my cheesesteak pink. No, that's, what the hell is the point in that? Save that for your T-bone. Not my cheesesteak. You'd be fully cooked meat.
Oh, Lord. So, food aside, how was your weekend?
Weekend was pretty nice. Well, you know about some of it. I went up there to visit you. It was a nice scenic drive. Rainy drive, too. But played some games up there. Chatted and such. But then the rest of the weekend was pretty laid back. I did a little bit of Father's Day stuff on Sunday, which was relaxing, and decided to get back on some like dormant games, mostly dungeon crawlers, like Labyrinth of Refrain still. I'm like on the post, I'm trying to get to the post game of that. And it's just lots of just wanting to relax and not falling asleep and losing wallets. Essentially, that's it. Also, I've been told I need to give up. No, I haven't been told. I've been contemplating giving up sugar. And you have no idea how difficult of a decision that is to even consider. I love sugar. It tastes freaking good. And I want it in everything. But it also
I'm drinking good. Soda right now, so I am imbibing sugar as we speak.
See, you know sugar. Sugar is the bee's knees. Yet it's also so bad. Why does it have to be so bad? It should be tasty and good for you. It just would make sense to be that way. Sugar should be healthy. In a perfect world, sugar would be healthy. Maybe that should be the thing. People like to bring up those things like, you know, favorite video game. Like if video game rules were real, what would you do? It should be something like sugary foods give you health point, hit point revivals. They're good for you. They actually give you haste and speed you up with none of the detrimental side effects. Sugar is suddenly good for you.
That would be amazing. World.
Yes, it would. Of course, I still want vegetables to be good for me too, but I just don't want to feel guilty for eating stuff that tastes, you know, stimulating. Sugar is stimulating. Vegetables are filling. I'm stimulating vegetable health. How about you? How's your weekend?
Oh man, I had a hectic weekend. We had our housewarming party this past weekend. It was called Flag Fest because it was for Flag Day.
That's what that was. I never understood that.
Yeah, Flag Day.
Okay. Now I understand it.
Yeah, we used to host old parties with a name that you can't really say anymore. So we decided to host it on Flag Day and go with Flag Fest instead. That's all. That's the only hint I'm giving away to that old name. But it was a fun time. Had a bunch of friends come in from out of town. You came up for the day on Saturday. Had a nice cookout. I got to watch my buddy Maze Dude beat Mortal Kombat 11 on Friday. That was pretty awesome. He just came down. He's like, hey, do you have the new Mortal Kombat? I was like, yeah, here it is. Check it out. And he's like, oh, what about story mode? Have you tried it yet? I'm like, nah. I did the multiplayer a bit, and I did the crypt a bit, and played online a few rounds, but I haven't had the time to jump into story mode yet. And he's like, oh, I'm going to check it out. 5 hours later, game over.
Just had to get that five, and like, you know, while I'm here, I'll just complete a game for you. Why the heck not?
Pretty much. Well, we started, and the cutscenes in that game are insane, by the way. There were stretches where the screen went idle because it took so long during a cutscene.
Jeez.
Like the screen dimmed. So they actually
went all in to try to give it like a full-on story mode.
Oh, yeah. Not only did they give it a full-on story mode, but they included the history of pretty much every past game in the series.
Wait, what? So is it? So you're telling me that it was a consistent plot across all 11 games?
In this game, yes. It takes pretty much everything into account. There's time travel in there. So they pretty much found a way to reboot the series and explain all of it.
Things that just you don't expect.
Yeah. Mortal Kombat had a fucking awesome story mode.
I would have never expected that. I generally don't expect that in any fighters, really. But to hear a Mortal Kombat game like that, that's a real mind blower.
Yeah.
Because those games were mostly about shock value to me.
Oh, don't get me wrong. The fatalities are insane in this new game. Like it's gotten to the point where they've gotten so violent that they're a parody of what they used to be.
Really?
They are just so over the top violent. Like, who was it? I think Shao Kahn or someone with a hammer hit them in the gut to knock them over, swung and hit the head, which then went through their entire body and flew out their ass with the spine attached.
Jesus. Now I see what you mean. I'm sure it was bloody as all hell to go with.
Oh, it's incredibly bloody, incredibly gory, but it is hilarious.
Gee, that's the kind of violence where I'm not even sure if it would bug me too much. I'd be like, well, this is humorous violence. I can't even take this seriously. It doesn't make me cringe. It just makes me stare at it and go, what the hell are they thinking with this mouse?
That's what they went for. They went for entertaining. It's just so over the top. So mindlessly over the top and gory that they're hilarious. I love them. It's so good.
Yeah, I can appreciate that. It's like Merry Christmas. It's a wacky mess. But how about, tell about the rest of your weekend?
That's pretty much the whole of my weekend. Just I had, I don't know, half a dozen to a dozen people come in from out of town and just crash here. Had family over, had the cookout. One of our buddies, Tosser, he juggled flaming batons for everybody, which was fun. Did you see you saw that, right? That. Him juggling?
Yeah. I'm almost positive I caught that.
And the food was delicious. Maze Dude cooked the food. I'm playing his music on this episode, by the way, because Maze Dude is awesome. But he was here and he cooked, and his burgers were delicious. The seasonings he added and a little bit of honey barbecue sauce, oh, they were fantastic.
Well, I'm having regrets because I somehow missed that. I ate hot dogs, but I don't think I ever had a burger.
Ah, you missed out, man.
Next time, he'll have to make out the show, or that, or he'll have to share his patented burger magic recipe.
I pretty much told you.
Seasonings?
Yes. Seasonings.
It could be anything of those seasonings. Anything.
I think he used onion and garlic powder, just a little bit of each, and then a dab of honey barbecue sauce, and smothered it in with a spoon and just cooked it.
Mm-hmm. Now we're talking.
It was nummy. Oh. Nummy.
We'll see. Maybe that'll be my weekend attempt to try to recreate delicious burger meat and go to town.
Yeah, but Maze Dude's not the only one who played a game this past weekend. You played something as well. Should we talk about it?
Yeah, let's do that.
We're doing a fun little special review this episode. A little bit of a retro throwback for 1001 Spikes, developed and published by Nicholas, released June 10th, 2014 on Xbox One for $14.99. So this is a little bit of an older title.
Ooh, yeah.
Wow, we basically celebrated its fifth anniversary. So
that, I can't complain about that because it was, well, I'll talk about it. But yeah.
But discover the lost treasures of Ucampa in South America as Aben Hawkins searches for his estranged father, world-famous archaeologist Jim Hawkins. Aben Hawkins races into the frozen tundra of the Antarctic, undiscovered temple ruins, and the vast caverns of South America in search of his father and the legendary treasure rumored to lie behind the golden door of Pacamum. Parnell, tell us about 1001 Spikes.
I can tell you that I can't pronounce half those damn tune names, but that's okay. But you don't have to be able to do that to understand this game. And what this game is an unexpectedly fun treat of a title. So the base mode of the game is a story mode in which Aben Hawkins, as Joe mentioned, is exploring ruins in hopes of catching up to and locating his estranged pop, who is also an archaeologist slash adventurer. Think Indiana Jones. However, unlike a lot of other games that tend to do the Indiana Jones thing, this game does it in a way where I feel like, similar to La Mulana, like this is what an actual Indiana Jones adventure would be. Mm-hmm. If you took out all the cartooniness and the, not cartoons, but the sense of Lucky, you know, always gets out of it in one piece, because this game hits hard, really hard. The exploration of the story mode breaks down to a series of stages, very short stages, no less. We're talking maybe a minute long as a maximum if you're really slow, and 30 seconds or so as a general rule. But the goal is the same on every level, which is to traverse the locale, locate the key, and then take the key to the exit door to get out of the stage. And all,
but Pernell, that sounds so easy.
It does sound easy. And baby, it's not, because between you and the key of that door are spikes. Maybe not 1001, but honestly, it's probably way more than that on some of the levels. There's a lot of spikes in this game. And in addition to this, other tricks and traps, just fireballs, statues that fire arrows, scorpions, things that you'd expect to see in a temple that aren't friendly and want to kill you. One hit death is the name of the game. And the only thing you're able to do is do a light hop, a tall jump, and throw daggers. That is it. That's all you can do. And with those abilities, you have to traverse these maps and get to the end. You start the game with 1,000 lives. 1,000.
1,001.
Oh, I'm sorry. Like the title.
Yes.
I've lost track so long ago. Burned through lives. But you start the game with 1,001 lives. And it's honestly rather excessive. But as you play through the game, you may come to find yourself, depending on if you're good at these kinds of games or if you're just learning the game, but one way or the other, you're going to burn through some of those lives, a good chunk of them, at least. Like, when I played the game, I would say that I didn't get below maybe 800, but that also is partly because there's also a hidden item on each stage, a golden skull, if you're playing as Aben Hawkins. I'll get into the other concept of that later. And if you collect that item, you get a one-up. So, depending on where the golden skull is located on the stage, that kind of offers you infinite retries without reducing your life count, because you'll just get the life, die until you pass the level. Of course, there are some levels where the skull is towards the end or in a location where by the time you get to it, you've already traversed the part of the level that was giving you the most trouble, so you don't really get the luxury of wash, rinse, repeat life structures. Also, at the end of each area, one of the area treasures being a key, which you'll likely use at the end of the game, will be acquired, and that gives you a random number of lives. It could be ranging from one life to 256 lives, but you'll just get a lot of lives. And of course, sometimes there's like a life down too, but I don't know what triggers that. It's just a weird thing that happens. But long story short, you will die a lot. The game is actually both fair and unfair at the same time, because it requires or almost demands expert timing and planning. Like, there'll be segments where you kind of have to remember or note that things are coming. And for a while, you might even play and start thinking about nonsense like Kaizo Mario or I Want to Be the Guy. Basically, games where they were intentionally designed to think about stuff you would do and then intentionally put traps in those locations to get you killed. But honestly, I can promise you, the traps in this game, while jerkish, are actually most of the time fair. There are a few where you stop and the game's like, yeah, I know he was going to stop there. Kill him. And just like a spike will show up or the floor will drop. But all things that you can get used to and that learn one more from. Goes, huh?
And things you can learn from.
Oh, yeah. Because you actually can attest to that. When I was playing at your house, there were levels that was giving me a lot of trouble, but then I had to go back later to get the golden skulls that I missed. And on a number of those stages, I just did better than the first time I did them. Like, I just wrecked them. And it didn't even seem like it. I got a speedrunner achievement when I finished it, too. So, which was very shocking. Though I also learned that when I beat the game, it was only halfway through the game, because there's a whole nother half of the game that they threw in there that you don't expect to even show up. But, and I'm a ways from getting through that, because, I feel like that might may alter my feeling on some of the stage design, because they do get brutal there from the very beginning on the Antarctica half of the game.
Oh, yeah.
But in addition to Abon Hawkins, you can also unlock a variety of other characters, sometimes based on a number of golden skulls you collect. I think sometimes you can get characters based on things you buy from the in-game shop, which you get whose currency you can get by playing the story mode with these other unlocked characters, which will allow you to get coins which can be spent at his store. The guy's name is like Council or something. So you can use the money there to buy new characters, to buy additional lives if you somehow start to run low. There's a number of weird things there, which I'm not even sure what all of them would do, because I don't have enough money to buy half the cool stuff. I'm still waiting to see what it'll turn out to be. But you even also unlock other modes in the game. Some are meatier than others, admittedly. There's one called the Lost Levels, where it's like a series of levels that are just brutal. But there's also two little smaller ones, one being the Golden Vase, where it's sort of like a 30-second minigame where you and other players are fighting to see who can collect the most money. And then there's the one, my favorite of the side levels, which is like the Tower of Nanad or something like that. And it's kind of designed to ape on the Tower of Juago on the title screen, but it's essentially a vertical ascent through levels to try to rescue a damsel from a cult. So think the normal game, but lengthier stages that all go upwards as opposed to vertical, horizontal. They all go vertical.
Damn.
But there's a lot of game in this, and there's a lot of fun to be had if you're the type of person that can handle getting his ass handed to him under the impression that you're going to get better and you'll cease to get your ass handed to you, or at least you'll get it handed to you less often. And, hey, if while you're getting better at it and learning the game, you have the awesome sounds by composer Rush Jet 1 to even make it feel like you're having a great time, even though you were legitimately suffering for your art. This game, I can't praise it enough. Again, this is a game that I would not have expected to enjoy. But as you can also attest to, I got to your house, started from stage 1, and played through the entire first half of the game, thinking it was the entire game. Oh, in one sitting, because I was enchanted by it. I wanted more, and I got more, because a lot more after what I finished.
You had the entire room just fixated on the TV watching you play this game.
And that's something I did not even expect. I'm like, wow, people were interested. It's like, at one point, one of your guests was like, hey, I'm rooting for you now. This is engaging.
It was. It was fun to watch. It was a really cool game. Meaty game. The amount of content in this game is ridiculous.
I agree. And it's an interesting concept too, because somebody might say, like, they might look at my in-game time. I think mine was like 2.5 hours, 3 hours or so for the first game that I did, for the first half of the game I played. But I don't know if that counts for all the deaths I had or what. And in addition to that, that's 2.5, 3 hours for me. Someone who's not good at these games or is still getting adjusted to it, it could take them a lot longer. And then again, like I said, there's a whole second half to the game. There are these other modes you can play. There's other characters you can unlock. And each of those characters play very differently. Like, there's one character that can do like a double jump and a glide. There's one character that gets a machine gun. One character gets like a forward dash. And they're all a bunch of like guest characters from various Nicolas games, like Cave Story. And a couple other games I didn't even realize were real until I did research on them, like Tempura of the Dead. But hey, well, I don't know. And I see some of these characters are even going to show up in the game that just came out last month called Crystal Crisis, because a number of the same guest characters show up as guests in that game too.
Yeah.
So some of their humbler beginnings.
Well, then overall, $15 on 1,001 spikes. What do you think?
I think it's worth every damn penny. Like, you'll probably, since it's as old as it is, you'll probably be able to catch it on a sale at this point, but I think it's worth full price if you can find it for that. It's just a lot of fun, well put together, heavily polished. Every death you have will be your fault, not the controller's fault. It's just quality, and I can't sing its praises enough.
Well, you stopped talking, so I'm guessing that you could sing its praises enough.
I'm restraining myself.
I understand.
So let me tell you about this guy named Avon now. Also, one thing I think is funny, like, I'm not sure if at one point it was called Avon Hawkins and 1,001 Spikes and then got changed to 1,001 Spikes, or if it was always called 1,001 Spikes, but the full title was just kind of like a sub name.
I think it's more the second one, where it was just always called 1,001 Spikes, but they had the full title, like, in the game.
Okay, that makes sense.
But the official release name is just 1,001 Spikes. I don't know.
Also, speedrunner is apparently a very, you said it's a rare trophy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, because like the achievement you said was you said it was considered super rare. Or like, what's the breakdown over this? Like, is, you said it was not just rare. You said it was like very rare or something. You said.
Now let me look it up. I'm say something to keep things occupied while I'm looking this up.
Interesting. So once upon a time, there once was a man from Nantucket. Ate his curds and
whey. Okay, maybe not Nantucket.
Yeah, but Nantucket's a great place to go for fishing and aquatic activities and just a general good time. But no, but like I got that speedrunner trophy because I've been playing it back at home too. Because when I got home from your place, I decided I needed to play through my copy of the game, which just was sitting dormant, untouched. So I played through that entire half of the game on my system, and quite frankly, I was doing way better here than I even did there, to go along with what I said earlier in the review. And I ended up getting the speedrunner trophy here too, to go along with the achievement I got up at your place.
Nice.
So I got the same thing. I got to beat the first half of the game. I got the speedrunner, and I got the one for getting all the golden skulls. So
now the speedrunner achievement, only 4.47% of gamers unlocked it.
Nice. See that? Yes. That just goes to show you. It's amazing. It makes you wonder how many of those people, was it because they just couldn't do it or because it was like, this game is frustrating me. But I call those guys early quitters, because this game is totally doable and it's totally fun. And maybe if enough people listen, we can get that to like 6%. Get on there and beat this damn game. It's worth your time. I promise. And it's so rewarding. When you get a good run on a stage, it feels good to watch it play through. Like, just watching yourself. I can't believe I did that shit.
Yeah.
Good feeling.
There were a bunch of times where, like, the room was cheering when you would do a stage.
It's like, oh, my God, he did. What the? Oh, my God, you did that. Yes. And I think the one that got the most praise was that fire level with the fireballs that were shooting up.
Oh, God, that jump. Fucking fire level.
They get the jump between the fireballs and the platform at the exact right time. And you only get one chance. Like, you can't mess it up, because if you mess it up, the floor that you jumped on won't be there anymore because it sinks.
Yep.
Got to get the timing right and just go.
Or, man, that one time where you entered the door and a fireball still hit you and killed you.
Oh, yeah, because it was like, come on, the animation to walk through the door was still happening. It's like, get in the door! It's like, poof, did it! Like, this game will get you. It gets you riled up. It gets the tension flowing. It's just great. Buy it and play it, I swear. I already reviewed it, but still, buy it and play the game. I'm telling you, I'm playing it right the heck now.
Are you?
Yeah, I'm doing the tower right now.
Nice.
It's worth it.
Nice. Well, Purnell, it is always a pleasure having you on chatting about 1001 Spikes, and it was a pleasure seeing you in person this weekend as well.
Playing 1001 Spikes.
Yes. Yes. You will have to come back up again and play Antarctica for us.
That is true, but I think at that point, I think in order to keep everybody from losing their marble, I have to try to beat that here first, and then go up there, because Antarctica seems to be much, much tougher than the stuff I did on the first half of the game. Like I said, they don't mess around from the start.
No, not at all. Mm-mm. But do you have any final words before we move on?
Nah, just know that I'm going to eat some delicious wings and pass the hell out. I earned it. Me and my stupid lost wallet that was in my gym bag.
All right, moving on. We got Chris Taylor joining us. Chris, how's it going?
Hey, going just fine.
How was your weekend?
Pretty good. Actually, as some people, long time listeners of the show may know, I do Twitch streams, and now I'm finally kind of back. I've got like one foot in the door doing some, so I've got my PlayStation 4 hooked up to stream, and I've been playing Skyrim now.
Nice.
Yeah. By the time this show comes out, I should be doing some streams on Skyrim, which I bought specifically for the reason that I just stated. And I'm going to be playing some legendary difficulty challenge runs and stuff, so it's going to be fun.
Are you just going to focus on streaming Skyrim, or are you going to do other games as well?
For now, Skyrim, but, you know, as other things kind of, I suppose as the winds change, I shall throw in some other stuff change. Too. I don't know. But, yeah, so that's exciting. That's my little self-plug at the front of the episode, I suppose.
Well, where can people find you?
You can find me at twitch.tv/liarexaggerate, like the character in Earthbound.
So just Google that, and then you'll know where to go.
Exactly.
Because it's spelled weird.
Yeah, LIERXAGERATE.
See, I told you.
Oh, there was a phone ringing.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Is it yours?
Professionals. No, it's not mine.
We are professionals. God damn it, we are.
And how was your weekend? Have we already talked about your weekend? I don't even know.
I talked with Purnell about my weekend. It was fun. It was my my Flag Fest housewarming party. That was really fun. A lot of friends came over, just hung out, played games. We ended up beating 1001 Spikes in Mortal Kombat 11.
Nice.
Well, the first half of 1001 Spikes. We thought we beat the game, but then after you beat the first half of the game, it opens up a second half of the game that we didn't know about.
Nah, I mean.
So we thought we beat it, but we beat the first half. And by I mean Purnell, by himself.
No. Oh. Not bad.
But I know you got a couple of games to talk about. Are you ready to dive into these?
Yeah, let's do it.
Awesome. The first game you're here to talk about is called Rolling Gunner, developed and published by Mebius, released June 20th on the Switch for $19.99. March 18th, 2061, Operation Downfall commences. Purnell, or God damn it. Can you tell I just recorded with him?
Yeah, totally.
Chris, tell us about Rolling Gunner.
All right, Rolling Gunner. One, I don't know why I always feel compelled to say this, but this is one that I requested. I begged on my hands and knees to get a copy of Rolling Gunner because, as y'all may know, I'm very much into shoot 'em ups or shmups. It's a contentious phrase that people either use or really, really hate for some reason.
Why do people hate shmups?
I don't know. It's like the same set of people that readily accept Metroidvania as a genre just can't shorten the word shoot 'em up to shmup. Otherwise, they're just livid. just blind with rage.
Screw them.
I know. So this shmup, me trying to stretch it out a little, is in the bullet hell category, which is also my favorite category. Bullet hells, I actually like to call them bullet heaven, even though that is the name of a publication that looks at these things. But I prefer bullet heaven because they're very beautiful to look at, and to get into them, you have to die. So, and not everybody's going to get into them. So.
Yeah, very true.
That's my metaphor there for it. But some people say bullet hell, and that's fine. I don't judge, clearly. Over here, judging games, but I won't judge people. So, yeah, the interesting thing about this one, and now the Switch has a ton of shmups, and I'm so happy about that. Like, it's, I would say, my second favorite genre behind RPGs, which, you know, it's no one's going to topple RPGs, but still, it's just such a satisfying, like, genre for me. And there's so many different kinds. It's not just, you know, you, although it all can be described as, you know, you're a ship and you know, you're against everything else on Earth and, you know, you just shoot everything and you're done. But, you know, you've got horizontal and vertically scrolling, you've got bullet hells, you've got kind of Euro style, a little bit more of a slowed down experience, and then sometimes you just have ones that are more about obstacle courses than actual gunplay. So this one sits very much, this is actually a rarity on the Switch because it is both a horizontally scrolling shooter and it is a bullet hell. We don't actually see that very often. About the closest thing you see in modern games is the Darius series, because Gradius tends to sit more in, like, dodging obstacles and, you know, taking down big bosses. It doesn't literally fill up the entire screen with brightly colored bullets, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you're just kind of dodging all kinds of stuff. And there is no... besides the Konami Anniversary Collection, there's no Gradius presence on the Switch, nor are there any Darius games, because, you know, Chronicle Saviors CE, I think, came out on PS4, but it has yet to land on Switch, and there's a Japan-only collection of the older Darius games, which don't really qualify as bullet hell. So this is a little bit of a rarity, which already kind of gives it some points. But the execution of this shooter impressed even me, and I was already going in expecting to be, like, impressed.
Yeah, you were excited about this one.
There's some, definitely some talk in the shmup community, although, of course, there's some people who kind of pooed it for being on the Switch. I think it's not even on Steam yet. I believe that the Switch is the only Western version of it, because this is a popular game in Japan, apparently, at least a well-regarded one. So, yeah, it's basic, you know, your basic storyline, which doesn't matter, is that robots have taken over the world, and they've taken this element that I suppose was necessary to their creation that has to be neutralized so that humanity can be saved, because it'll neutralize the robots. And so you fly a ship that is kind of carrying a sort of almost sentient gunner that floats around it that is something that will neutralize said material. It's already too confusing, but, you know, story doesn't matter. What it comes down to is that you're a ship with a flying sort of almost like an option ship, almost like an R-type attachment, but that is your thing, and then you're shooting, you know, not only enemy ships but giant robots, which is, you know, of course, par for the course. But so the way that the movement goes in this game is that your ship moves, and then the placement of the extra gunner is, you know, whatever opposite movements you're making. So if you go backwards, then the thing goes forwards. If you go up, it goes down, and, you know, all around. You know, you have full range of control. So in that, you know, a game that is a lot like that is Prehistoric Isle, which I reviewed the sequel, but a lot of people haven't played the original Prehistoric Isle. It's on the SNK Anniversary Collection. But basically, it's a thing in shooters to have the sort of, you know, this thing will shoot, but it points in the opposite direction of where you're going. What the difference is in this game is that you can lock it into place if you shoot with the Y button, or you can shoot with the right, the right rear, the big squishy button on the right side shoulder. Not the bumper,
right trigger.
The trigger. Yeah, right trigger. There we go. I was struggling to come up with that word. And I'm talking about a shooting thing and I forgot the word trigger. Anyways, if you hold down the right trigger, then it will allow for free motion and it will just continually shoot while, you know, real time going in whatever direction you're flinging it into. Whereas most shooters that use this kind of tactic, like RXN Ragen, which is a pretty expensive, well, it was an expensive eShop download. They lowered the price permanently from $38 to $9.99.
Oh, nice.
I think they realized people weren't buying it. I bought the physical edition, so I actually paid more than both of those combined. But anyway. but, you know, RXN Ragen has one ship that has this as an option. You know, like I said, this is a common playing style for shooters. But what is interesting about this game is that it actually builds each and every level to have many, many, like, just constant segments where you do have to actually pay attention to where that other shooter bit is, and you actually do have to, like, maneuver around an endless sea of enemy bullets and actual enemies in order to get your ship into position and, you know, fire through. Several bosses have this as a thing as well. So you'll be attacking a boss and then suddenly a second boss will appear behind you and you have to deal with both of them at once. It's incredibly exhilarating. I actually was really on my toes on this game at all times. And the cool thing is, you know, despite this very hardcore sounding, and it is a hardcore game, but despite all this, it not only has an easy difficulty, like, you know, it has four difficulty settings, has easy, normal, hard, hardest. Easy is how I beat it the first time. I actually beat it today, so because you get to spam continues. The game, the game has automatic free play, which is excellent. I think in a home shooter, you know, I don't like it when they force you to start over. However, the ending I got was a major bummer. So I assume that you either have to beat it on a higher difficulty or without using a continue or something. This clearly seems to have multiple endings, although I couldn't get Google to tell me about that. So that remains in the air. But the other thing is that there's an easier than easy mode where it's actually a separate option in the menu called novice mode. And so this is actually a game that's really easy to get into for people who aren't normally into shooters. And, I really recommend that you do, because, the one thing that I haven't touched on yet is that the thing about bullet hells that is important is that they look impressive, that they fill up the screen with all these brightly colored bullets and just this mesmerizing pattern. And, you know, this game is possibly the best I've seen in the genre, like, ever. It is.
Damn.
It is miraculously beautiful, just for the bullet patterns and, you know, some of the design aspects and things like that. It actually is not the most high def thing in the world. It actually looks a little bit more like a Dreamcast game, which should excite some shooter fans, because the Dreamcast had several non-American shooters that have a lot of fans, including the original Ikaruga. But, while, you know, the backgrounds and enemies and stuff, they're good. They're very, very good. The actual patterns of bullets and things that you can see coming from bosses and stuff like that is just jaw-dropping. So if you're into that aspect of bullet hells, the only other game I've seen that looks this good is Shikondo Soul Eater, which is an extremely cheap game that I also recommend. It's a vertical shooter.
Nice.
But, yeah, it's like, it's just so cool. Like, you know, purple and blue and just like, you know, really, even in easy mode, there were bosses and enemies. Like, in fact, the last two levels were entirely this way that would just, you know, start firing stuff. And you just have to find like the tiny spots on the screen to hide in because the entire screen will be full of bullets.
Jeez.
Yeah, I love it. And in fact, the game has so many options. You can even choose from three colors as to what the core of your ship is going to look like the actual part that can't get hit.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And the things, I could just keep going on and on. The another cool thing about this one that I've not noticed in most shmups, at least on the Switch, is that it has a replay system whereby it records your entire game. And then makes it available to playback, and you can save up to 8 of them.
Damn.
I think it's 8 of them. It might be even more, but, you know, it had a list. And so, yeah, when I beat the game, I actually saved it, and that's really great, not only for showing people the game without actually having to be like, I can't get to the last boss, though. But it also, it's great for actually studying the game and studying the bullet patterns and seeing what you did wrong. And like, you know, this is a thing that people who play these games really appreciate. It also has a separate training section where I think you don't take damage, and it has a tutorial that you can turn on or off. It even has an e-manual with it, which is kind of great. So yeah, just like all kinds of stuff in this thing.
Well, overall, $20. I'm sure I don't even need to ask. I kind of have an idea how this is going, but $20, what do you say?
Yeah, $20. I mean, the closest I can compare this to in terms of, like, you know, in terms of games is, like I said, Darius Burst Chronicles CE, which is on PlayStation 4 for the full 60 clams. And I would say this game is not only comparable, in some ways it's better. And, you know, Darius is my favorite series, but I also, like I said, I have a deep appreciation for really good looking bullet hell shooters. And yeah, this one really impressed me. Like, you know, I would absolutely recommend this for any shooter fan or any person who wants to get into shooters without having to play an ultra difficult game that they're going to not enjoy because they just die too much.
Yeah.
So all around, I mean, they pretty much knocked this one out of the park. It's absolutely stunning.
And the best part, it happens on March 18th, which is my birthday. So,
yay!
Hooray, the end of civilization takes place on my birthday in 2061.
Oh, boy. Well, you know, plenty of time to get good at this game, then.
Very true. I have lots of time, if I even make it to 2061.
Right.
That would be me making it to 80 years old. I don't see that happening.
Yeah, pretty much same.
Good stuff. But next game to talk about is called Platigo, Super Platform Game Maker, developed by Super Icon, published by P-Cube, released June 13th on the Switch for $19.99. Platigo is the simple, super simple platform game maker that everyone of all ages can enjoy. No need to code, no need for complex scripting. Platigo is a 100% drag and drop tool that lets you start making platform games immediately. No fuss, no tutorial, just jump straight in and start creating. Chris, tell us about Platigo.
Okay, Platigo. So this one was really, of course, interesting to me because doing the make-it-yourself video game stuff is kind of hit or miss. Like I really enjoyed RPG Maker, for instance, but I could never get my game finished because I couldn't figure out how to do collision detection well enough that I could get, you know, it was like there was a lot of things that I wasn't getting.
Yeah.
That were absent, of course, from any sort of explanation. Perhaps if it had an instruction manual or something, that would be good. And while this game also kind of doesn't have any sort of tutorials to sort of teach you how to use the tools, it's at least intuitive enough that I figured out most things that I was able to do with it. I actually found out after the fact that you can control certain aspects of your player actions. So you can actually choose whether you want to make your character be able to double jump or wall jump or how high they can jump.
That's cool.
Yeah, I thought it was just the double jump and that's it. But the one cool thing is that there's a lot of developer-made example levels kind of thing that you can access. However, I will say that the UI, the actual interface is a little unusual. Like, it's kind of tough to figure out what goes where, and once you get into like choosing what stage, it doesn't actually say which ones were made by the developer. It's just they're kind of at the top of the list because they're the most complete. It sorts it through how complete, I guess, the thing is. But anyway, all that to say that you get into the creation mode and you basically have a ton of tools. Like, so you choose your different platform types, what kind of ground you have, what kind of obstacles you want to create. You can make them in three different layers of the world, so you can put stuff in the background that you can walk in front of, you can put stuff in the foreground, into the middle ground, which is where your character action is going to happen, and you can put stuff in the foreground. So, pretty good options there. Now, for pretty much everything that you want to choose, so you like want to choose, let's say, a single wide platform area, it will pull up a list of just about like, usually the average was like somewhere between 10 and 20 different graphics that you can put in. And so there's a lot of design freedom, although there is no, of course, option to just create your own, which, you know, is something that some of these game creators have, and it arguably works. So this one you're just kind of choosing from a list as to what you want to do. So you choose, like, basically... Like, there's, like I said, it's just a overwhelming amount of options of stuff you can choose. And of course, a lot of people are going to draw comparisons to Mario Maker on this one. Whereas this one is, like, kind of more generic than Mario, but also cheaper. So that's something that's going for it. As far as, like, placing enemies in your stage, you can choose, they simplify them to basically being, like, this is a shooting type. This is a turret. This is one that's going to bounce up and down. And, you know, so you place them in. And then it actually has this other feature, which is really interesting, in that you kind of choose the overall flavor of the game that you're creating. So you're not actually choosing from a list of enemies. They just change based on what flavor of level that you're choosing. Oh. And so we've got... You know, sort of, we got fantasy, we got horror, we've got, you know, different things like that. And then, you know, like, really general feels. And then it actually has these kind of a pastiche, I suppose, or just like a sort of just kind of looks like an NES game. Like, it actually shows an NES and you choose that. And then the music becomes chiptune and, like, the stages become... You know, that sort of 8-bit look. And then you can choose, like, make it 16-bit, make it more like Super Nintendo. And they also have a Game Boy icon, so you can make it monochrome. And, you know, background music changes accordingly. And it even has some obscure, well, not obscure, but I suppose old computer styles. So you have, like, your Sinclair and your Commodore 64 and your ZX Spectrum look as well.
Oh, wow.
Funny enough, they won't give the names of the actual computers, so those were just my best guesses. In fact, the lack of text is a little bit of something that was an obstacle for me, because sometimes I'm like, what does this do, or what happens? And I click it, and it doesn't say anything, so I just kind of have to play around with it and guess. So, you know. As far as, like, these creators go, like, this is pretty much the most intuitive one that I've used yet, in that, really, no matter what happens, you can basically just pick something and then make something out of it. You know, you can do, like I said, spike pits, fireballs that go up and down, spinning blades, moving platforms. Like I said, the whole game plays out always, you know, as a platformer. Oh, and you can also throw in a jetpack so you can create your levels and make vertical challenges as well.
Which nice. That's
pretty cool, too. and you can set checkpoints, which is kind of cool, too. When it comes down to it, it all becomes pretty much the same game. That is to say, you have a boy character and a girl character. You know, you choose how they're able to jump, but they're always going to be the same character. So it's basically just taking this sort of you know, kind of like a generic looking kind of game and just, you know, playing with the actual mechanics of it. I'd say this is a great thing to use to actually learn how to sort of design and set up games in this genre, because, you know, platformers are really interesting in that you kind of have to find that balance between difficulty and reward and, you know, making it intuitive in order for somebody to actually play it.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, to find out if you succeeded or failed at that, you can upload your levels to where other players of the game can then download them and play through them. And they can rank you.
So if you suck, the world will let you know.
Exactly. And the thing that I like about this game as well is that once you're done with a level, you can actually choose to string together levels, and then it'll kind of put them onto a map, sort of like Super Mario World style.
Oh, that's neat.
And yeah, and then you can, you know, rate the difficulty and things like that. So you can actually create an entire game out of, you know, separate levels that you've designed. And the game has a pretty good amount of memory that it'll let you use for all this stuff. So, I mean, you can really make something pretty ambitious with it. It's just, you know, the trade-off of usability versus, like, limitations. This one's much more tilted towards the usability spectrum. And thus, you know, it kind of comes away from the having less limitations.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, $20 on it, what do you say?
Well, $20, that's a pretty good deal for a game maker like this. I think that's about as cheap as I've seen them. And like I said, this is a great tool for beginners, such as myself, by the way. And if you happen to have this game and get out there, I actually have uploaded my first level. It's completely bullshit. It's called SML, and it's by Chris with an exclamation point.
Nice.
Yeah, and it's only one screen. It's you, and you can see the exit to the level from where you start, and there's a checkpoint halfway between.
Oh, Jesus.
And then there's also enough obstacles that you're going to get very mad at me. So, you know, go on there and rate it a one star or whatever you want to do. I just wanted to at least upload something that I was playing around with and be like, hey, I made something.
Nice.
So that's on there.
Awesome. I will have to check that out myself because I was planning on picking this one up too.
Yeah, it would be cool to like compare levels and like, you know, like I said, it, you know, the amount of time I had with it wasn't enough to make something really ambitious, but at least I could see where I could make something ambitious. And in fact, I might go back to it and work on some stuff. Oh, I did want to add right quick, by the way, that it, you know, obviously it works with the touchscreen on the Switch, which is the much better interface. Otherwise, you're just controlling a cursor with the joystick. So definitely get your hands literally on this one. you know, make sure you got either a stylus or a very pointy finger because the icons are very small. Like they don't change them when you're moving from a big screen TV to the actual Switch screen. No. So sometimes stuff's a little harder to poke.
Gotcha.
But you'll get it.
Yeah, I know I will.
Yeah.
Well, the next game to talk about is called Phantom Doctrine, developed by Creative Forge Games and Forever Entertainment, published by Forever Entertainment, released June 13th on the Switch for $17.99. The year is 1983. The world teeters on the verge of destruction as the Cold War tightens its icy grip. East or West, trust no one, question everything. Chris, tell us about it.
All right, Phantom Doctrine. Well, this is a really interesting one, but I do want to point out right quick that I enjoy how ominous Forever Entertainment sounds. This is your Forever Entertainment. Anyway, no, they're good. Okay, so Phantom Doctrine is a... Well, okay, so I was looking at a different review of it, and it said this game is based on XCOM 2. So, I've never played an XCOM game or even seen one in my entire life, but I do keep hearing that name. I definitely hear it all the time when it comes to Mario versus Rabbids or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's if I would have ever played an XCOM game, then I could really shortcut this review. So, I'm going to have to take the long way around, but I guess the short way around... For people who, you know, are too impatient to listen to all of the 10-minute review on a 2-hour podcast or however long. Anyway, whatever.
This will be a shorter one, actually.
I'm making fun of my straw man, okay? Okay, so Phantom Doctrine is an espionage game where you basically, you're one set of spies and you are trying to take down the other set of spies. Now, right off the top of the game, you can actually choose to be US or KGB. So you can actually join the bad guys of the 80s for this one if you so choose. It apparently doesn't mess with the missions too much. It just more or less determines what the story is going to be like.
Yeah.
But in fact, it's a lot of it is just like it's less concerned with world events and things like that, and more like internal stuff, like who's a spy, who's going to double cross you, who's going to like give you the information. You know, who are you trying to find so you can get out there and catch them, or, you know, spy stuff. And the game boasts a, like, I think it's like a 40-plus hour campaign, which I believe it, like having played the first couple levels and such. This is a slower-paced game for sure. And like I said, the interface is, well, for the action parts, because there's actually more than just action in this game, but for the action parts, it is essentially an RPG. It is a isometric, grid-based tactical game. So, you know, something like your, you know, Fire Emblem, Shining Force, you know, Final Fantasy Tactics. We've played this kind of game before.
Yeah.
God Wars is one I reviewed. However, instead of merely getting onto the battlefield and, you know, using your weapons on the enemies and, you know, then healing yourself and gaining experience and levels and things like that, the way it actually plays out is that there's several buildings and there's goals, and you actually have to meet the goals rather than just destroy the enemy. And in fact, the very first level, you're not supposed to engage the enemy at all. You actually are supposed to then, you know, you move around different spots, and if there's a spot that has, like, the documents that you need, for instance, you move in front of them and press X, and then your person goes over there and grabs the documents, and then you gotta hightail it before you're caught. So you're actually using a tactical strategy RPG to not fight.
Interesting.
Yeah, instead you got to find different ways around. You have to find out what kind of terrain provides the most cover. And, you know, if possible, or if necessary, rather, you can use your guns. You can sneak up on an enemy or a civilian even. There's sometimes civilians that get thrown into the mix and choose to, like, incapacitate them or, you know, so it's a non-lethal way to just take them out of the battle. But if an enemy, like, comes upon the body, then they'll be like, oh, and then they'll ring the alarm, and then reinforcements will start coming. In fact, the first time I tried to get through the first level, I was like, well, nuts to this. I got guns. I'm going to use them. there's only two people here. But yeah, as soon as it flipped the alarm, like, reinforcements just kept coming. And, you know, the way that the missions are set up, you just don't have the manpower to take down all these people. Like, you know, in that first level, I only had three spies. And in fact, if a spy goes down, you got to carry him out of the mission. Otherwise, they're just out of the game.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So it's a game that really it's a tense game that actually really requires you to be on your feet at all times. And not just for, you know, shooting people, it's for getting the stuff that you need and getting out of there. And then in between, you know, when there's not action sections, then you're actually poring over, like, documents and reading names and trying to make links. And you actually, like, choose different things on your documents to sort of throw up onto a corkboard and then make, like, literally do the thing that they do in the spy movies where they have the corkboard full of, like, names and newspaper clippings that they're putting lines between. This is that kind of game.
Awesome.
Yeah, and so, you know, I didn't get far enough to really get, you know, start seeing the, like, double crossing and, like, the, you know, real, you know, seeing, like, threads start to come together or anything like that. Because, like I said, just the action part of this game was super long. Every time I tried it, it took, like, maybe about 30 minutes to make an attempt. And I made a few attempts because this game's actually really difficult if you're not if you're not really paying attention and learning your environments and things like that.
And when, like, you go guns blazing,
it doesn't work. Apparently there are stages where you are supposed to actually take out people, and then they just better equip you for it. And yeah, it's like pretty cool. Like, and it has a, it has a character creator that's kind of funny to me, because, you can make your people look pretty goofy, and then you can just choose a completely different picture to use for them. And then you choose their name, and then it like gives them a code name anyway. So it's, I don't know. I kind of question the character creator aspect of it, but hey, it gets you your own avatar into this strange world of 80s espionage.
Very true.
Yeah. So for sure, this is like, you know, this isn't something like, you know, this is kind of close to Wastelands, which I reviewed, where that is to say it's a tactical game with gunplay. But unlike that game, this is very much a different vein. This is really for people who like to get in there and intellectualize and like strategize and like learn things and read things and like kind of absorb themselves into the world so that they can make, you know, better decisions and stuff. It's definitely not just a pick up and play kind of game. So I would actually say, apart from some of the survival games, this is one of the more I would say esoteric Switch games that I've played.
Look at you using big words.
It's only three syllables. No, it's four syllables. Damn it.
Oh, shit. Well, for $18, Phantom Doctrine, what do you say?
Like, there's an audience for this game for sure. Your spy novel type of, you know, people who really like being crack secret, elite secret, and crack, and sneaking around and doing all that stuff. It definitely is a, like, breath of fresh air for, you know, tactical games, because it's all about trying to figure out a better way of doing things. So for people who really like to overthink and strategize and, like, you know, get into this stuff, absolutely worth the money. For anybody who's going in expecting a quick action game, you're going to be, you know, you're going to be basically throwing your controller pretty soon. One, I mean, the, you know, as far as like how slow this game moves, it's every time that you're done with your moves and you know, you then hit the space button or the minus button, I guess you could say, the dash button, whatever, to end your turn, it then goes into the enemies doing their turn, and it's like this really slow crawling progress bar. And no matter what the enemies choose to do, you have to wait for that progress bar, and it's almost always the same amount of time. So this is very much for people who like to slow down and really take things in. So if you are one of those people, then this is, yeah, I definitely recommend this game to you, because it seems to have a ton of content, and it really seems to play out in all kinds of different ways. So, yeah, I'd say go for it.
Awesome. Well, one final game to talk about tonight is called Horizon Shift 81, developed by Flump Studios, which is an incredible name.
That's a good name.
Published by Funbox Media, released June 11th on Switch, PS4, and Steam for $9.99. Horizon Shift is an explosive wave-based single-screen shooter with a ton of new ideas and platformer elements. Do what it takes to protect your horizon from the ever-encroaching enemy attack. Chris, tell us about Horizon Shift 81.
All right, Horizon Shift 81, second shooter of the review. But this one is much different. As I said, they're different shmups. This one is much more in the arcade classic, your sort of Galaga territory or Space Invaders, or even Asteroids. It actually has elements of Asteroids in it. So this game definitely looks like an old arcade game, but I mean, it really functions as kind of this love letter to all kinds of old, like, you know, basic sprite based gaming. So we got a few different things going here. So the main thing about it is that the actual playing field is a screen that is split in half. There's a line in the middle. Your ship goes on that line, and it can move left and right or up and down. That is to say, it can either shoot upwards towards enemies that are coming to you from that side of the line, or downwards towards enemies that are coming up to you from that side of the line. So it's very much being in the middle of the screen and sort of standing your ground. The other, like controls of it are that you have a jump button where you can jump over certain obstacles that will get in your way, or breaks in the line, because certain things can break the line. And if you fall off, then that's a life. And then there's a dash button that you can either dash left or right, and that will take out enemies as long as they touch the force field and you're dashing in the right direction. And it also just gets you to a different part of the playing field if you need to get there in a hurry. So the type of enemies that you find in this game range greatly in size and type. So you've got your, you know, Galaga-style insect robot things that are, you know, just kind of coming out of the woodworks to get at you. You also have asteroids, like literal asteroids from the game Asteroids, that are coming at you. And those, like I said, can break the line, and therefore you kind of have to, you know, blip them out until they, you know, shoot at them before they, you know, get down there or crush you. And then there are, you know, different enemies. There's actually centipedes, or millipedes, actually. Well, what's the Atari game? I guess it's Centipede.
Both of them, I guess.
It's the long enemies that, like, kind of snake on down to you, and you have to shoot them enough times that they completely blow up.
Yeah.
And then there's every five levels, there's a boss fight, and the boss usually... They usually drop the line to the, like, the bottom of the screen, and then the boss takes up like half of the screen by itself. Ooh. So you have like giant, even though they're basic sprites, they're still like giant bosses, and like they usually have some kind of gimmick to them as well. So like, it's a game that looks simple on the surface, but it's deceptive. It quickly becomes a really advanced, intense fighter or shooter rather. And, if that wasn't enough, there's actually a bonus level, which instead of your ship being just the ship, it is now a paddle, and then you actually play Arkanoid.
Oh, God.
Yeah, so it has bonus levels that actually bring in Breakout, which I've never seen that in a shooter before. And you still have your dash move, too, and you have to use it. So, yeah, then, you know, becomes all that stuff. And the game quickly becomes difficult. Like, I actually died many, many times on stage, just as low as stage 7. But the fortunate thing is that the game, unlike arcade games of old, will actually create checkpoints for you. Ooh. So, yeah, you can actually make slow progress through this game. You don't have to start over at stage 1 every time, which is kind of good, because the first few stages are, like, straight-up tutorials, and they're unskippable. So,
yeah.
It's really nice that once you beat that first boss, you can just start over. You can start from there, and it's just fine. So, of course, because this is a classic arcade game, it's got several different options as to what you can, how you can look at the game. And I really appreciate that. So, you know, they of course have the clean screen, which is how I play. I just like to see everything in high def, because I play on a high def system. That's what I paid for. But you can get, you know, horizontal lines on the screen if you so desire. You can also give it that kind of retro look where it looks like an arcade game that's just had too many, you know, greasy fingers on it. So, like, there's, you know, light trailing and things like that. And then there's a mode that's like that, only super, like, very much so. Like, the screen is super blurry. And, like, the lights are, like, really trailing, and it's just terrible to look at.
Oh, Lord.
And, yeah. And then you've got, actually a couple of different options for what you want your background to look like. You can kind of get this neon-looking background, or what they call retro Starfield. And then, of course, my favorite thing is that this does have a vertical mode. So if you got one of those flip grips, you can actually play this in vertical.
Which, yeah, I saw you post on Facebook that you were excited to use the flip grip on it.
Oh, yes, for sure. Oh, and it actually has a variable glow level. And you can put that glow level up to 99. And, yeah, the game is basically, like, you can't tell what's going on anymore at that point. So, like, the amount of grease you can throw on the screen in this game is impressive in and of itself.
I kind of want to pick it up just to see it at max settings.
It looks gross. I love it. I love it because there's the option to not have it there. And the other thing that I actually really quite like about it, well, It has like six game modes, two of which you have to unlock. It's free mode and boss mode, I guess, once you play through the entire game. But it has like one of the modes is called speed up, where every time you beat a level, it gets faster. And like, it gets uncomfortably fast pretty quickly.
Nice.
And then, yeah, like there's, like I said, there's so many options in this freaking game. There was one I was going to look for on this. Oh yeah. So the gamepad types, it actually has, 6 different ways to set the controllers. And, there was one I was particularly, enamored with. Of course, there's the one where you just, you know, you move left and right and the A button shoots or whatever. And then, you know, you use a different button to switch sides and all this other stuff. There's one where you can actually kind of do it twin stick shooter style. That is to say, you move left to right with the left stick, and then you move up and down with the right stick, and whatever direction up and down that you go in, you start shooting.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so you can actually control most of it with just the two sticks, and then one trigger button for jump and one trigger button for dash, which I think is mode E. But I'm really glad that they radically have different control styles rather than just using different face buttons for different activities.
Yeah.
So a very well thought out game for what it looks like, for sure.
Well, then $10 on it, what do you say?
$10, if you've ever played an arcade game in the 80s or, you know, had an Atari 2600, you really have to pick this one up just to see all the crazy stuff that they do that's based on these older games. And in and of itself, it's a fine game. I think it's actually really fun, even if you don't know what's going on. As far as single-screen shooters go, this is about the best modern entry I've seen. You know, that wasn't just a straight rip of something else, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, for sure, I would say $10 is worth it. Check this one out.
Awesome. Sounds good.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that is it for this episode. Thanks again to Pernell for coming on chatting. Chris, thank you for doing your thing as well.
Heck yeah.
Music this episode is going to be some Maze Dude, because he was an awesome cook at my party, and I'm going to celebrate him with his music.
Huzzah!
Huzzah, indeed.
Forward.
Chris, do you have any final words to end the show?
Hell, I don't know. Go watch me on Twitch if you want. I need people to watch.